Thank you for listening to this podcast from KX93.5, Laguna's only FM. We invite you to listen to more music and talk on our grassroots non-profit radio station in Laguna Beach, California, from anywhere in the world on kx935.com/listen or on our smartphone apps. But right now, here's that podcast from KX93.5.
Good morning, Laguna Beach. Thank you for joining me today, and thank you to all our friends in places beyond. Coming to you from the heart of the village in beautiful Laguna Beach, California, America's Côte d'Azur, or Azure Coast, you're listening to Perspectives with Dr. Ari Grayson. I'm Ari, and I have a really nice show in store for you today. Joining me in the studio is a Laguna Beach treasure, 92-year young Arnold Haino. Mr. Haino is a resident of Laguna Beach since 1955, and he's the author of over 24 books, including biographies of Willie Mays, Sandy Koufax, and Roberto Clemente. As a freelance writer, he's written hundreds of articles and columns. He taught writing at USC's Pitzer College and at the University of California at Irvine. His latest book is a collection of columns about our very own Laguna Beach. The book is It Takes a Villager, Wit and Witticism by Laguna's Irreverent Observer. So it's my pleasure to present to you Mr. Arnold Haino. Welcome to my studio. I'd like to begin by asking you to tell me, whom do you most admire and who do you most respect as a writer, and why that is?
Different times, different writers, different... you can't have the same heroes when you're 6 or 8 years old as when you're 60 or 80 or 92. When I was a kid, I'm a reader who is avaricious. I eat it up. I gollop it. And in the beginning, it would be the Tom Swift and the Hardy Boys and the Rover Boys and Baseball Joe and Bamba the Jungle Boy. And then later on, it would be Treasure Island, which is a marvelous book, which I read over and over and over again, and Tom Sawyer, which I read over and over and over again, before I found Huckleberry Finn, which I then read over and over and over again. But in my adulthood, or in my adolescence, it was Thomas Wolfe, because he had that goat cry of adolescence in him, and he was able to let that be heard 800 pages away sometimes, but it was wonderful, and I was thrilled by it. I don't know how that would read today. I read Hemingway and loved Hemingway, the short story, the Nick Adams short stories in particular. There's one story, the second story he ever wrote, called Indian Camp. It remains with me. I read it over every so often. It's an absolutely great piece of writing, and it became a farewell to arms later on when he turned from short story writing to novel writing. If you read the two, you'll see how similar they are. And anyway, today I look for more calmness in my heroes, Anne Tyler, for instance, Alice Munro, people like that, William Trevor. And sometimes I leap across the ocean and Dickens. I think Bleak House is the greatest novel in the English language. Other people will tell me, no, it's got to be Ulysses, et cetera, et cetera. No, it doesn't got to be Ulysses. It's something that I can read and understand, and that helps. And so heroes come and go. The most influential book I ever read was a book titled The Life and Death of a Spanish Town by Eliot Paul. I read it coming back from combat in World War II from the Pacific, and landing eventually in Seattle, and on the ship, which broke down, by the way, in the middle of the ocean at one time, which is a very scary thing when there were Japanese submarines all around. I found this tattered copy of something called The Life and Death of a Spanish Town, and I read it, and it was my first inkling that war can be not just what I thought it was, but something far, far worse. The cliche war is hell is a reality, and hell descended upon this little Spanish town in the form of Franco's forces during the Spanish Revolution, and this was the the death and murder and strangulation and starvation of a whole town. Very similar in style to John Hersey's Hiroshima, or Hiroshima, I don't know how they pronounce it today. But this is a whole town's worth, and it remains with me a moving, epical moment, because I had been in combat, and now I was being confronted with what combat really was like elsewhere, and I guess it was my first beginnings of becoming a pacifist.
Okay. You mentioned a couple of Mark Twain's most famous books. I'm wondering whether you've ever read Mark Twain's Letters from the Earth. That's one of my personal favorites.
I don't know what... Say it again. Letters from the Earth?
Letters from the Earth.
No, I don't know that at all.
Oh, my goodness. I'll have to get a copy for you.
Okay.
It's an absolutely wonderful book. Uh-huh. The premise for the Earth, for the Letters from the Earth, is that there's the three archangels, Gabriel, Michael, and Lucifer. And Lucifer, being true to who Lucifer is, uh-huh, is always doing things and falling from God's grace. So he does something particularly egregious at one point, really, really pisses off God. So God banishes him, Lucifer, to the earth. So the letters from the earth are Lucifer's letters back from the earth, telling about his experiences there. And they're absolutely wonderful, because he begins with Adam and Eve and then works his way all the way through to Twain's contemporary time. And he talks about what a sarcasm human beings are. There are a lot of really wonderful, wonderful letters there. I think you would enjoy it tremendously. Uh-huh. But most people are so familiar with Mark Twain in terms of his children's stories that they oftentimes overlook or forget the fact that he was a very prolific writer, had a tremendous sarcastic wit, and was a great observer of the human condition. And I see a lot of what he does in the kind of work that you've done, in the columns that you put together in It Takes a Villager. This could be coming from Mark Twain's own pen, so I enjoy it enormously.
Thank you very much. That's one of the nicest compliments I've ever had.
It's quite true, and I think Twain himself would concur on that. But let's not speak for historical figures when they're not able to speak for themselves. But another great writer who I see similarities in your style, and I think I've mentioned this to you on a previous occasion, is Russell Baker. For those people who may or may not remember Russell Baker, he was a columnist for the New York Times, and his columns were published in the Sunday Observer.
Uh-huh.
And there are some really, really wonderful stories there. Are you familiar with Russell Baker?
Only slightly. I read and liked the little bit that I know of him.
Well, one of my favorite articles of his in the in one book that he put together, and again, I keep referring to them as articles, but truly columns. But one of his columns was about the Democrats coming to New York for the 1976 National Convention. And as he tells it, obviously New York at that time was undergoing a financial crisis, and Times Square is not the place we know it to be today. It was kind of a very seedy red light district, if you will, with a lot of adult bookstores and whatever other kind of things go along with that. But of course, the mayor, taking a lot of pride in the city, wanted to make sure that Times Square was cleaned up for the Democrats. And Baker's comment was that trying to shelter a Democrat from depravity was like trying to shelter a fish from water.
1976, yes, but you can go back a ways. I attended the 1960 Democratic Presidential Convention. I had press credentials for that. And Bonnie, my wife, was a Golden Girl. She was an escort for the Maryland delegation. I described the Maryland delegation this way. It was headed by the Attorney General of Maryland, a young guy, who soon would become the governor of Maryland, and soon thereafter became a convict. And that is the way the Democrats were in those days. The Hague people, the Daley people, the Pendergrass people, depravity within the ranks was was very democratic in those days.
Well, you know what? Now, you know, thank goodness it's a nonpartisan issue. We see so much of that in both sides.
Uh-huh.
And it's funny because I wasn't familiar with the Democratic candidate that had legal issues in Maryland, but I thought you were talking about Spiro Agnew, who later became vice president.
That's right.
And had to resign after his scandals. But of course, anybody who knew him back in his old days in Maryland politics never saw that one coming. So, you know, one of the things that I wanted to find out from you is, you know, as such a prolific writer over such an extensive period of time, you know, what do you consider to be some of the most essential aspects of becoming a good writer? Because I'd like to hope that there are lots of people out there, whether young or old, who feel that they may have it in them to do just what you've done.
I used to tell students of writing that clarity was the most important aspect. Today, I'm not so sure. I think sometimes a little obscurity, a little bit of noir atmosphere helps a piece of writing. I think directness is incredibly important. Know where you want to go with what you are saying and get there in the most direct way. The excursions may be of interest to you personally, but a critic came to a class of mine once and used the term, kill your little darlings. And every time you write something that just appeals to you and you just love it madly, forget it. Just get rid of it. That's not going to work. You kill your little darlings and you will be much better off. And then as I develop into writing short stories and then writing novels, storytelling is a hidden virtue to a lot of writers. They don't realize how people love stories. And I tell stories as often as I possibly can and let the stories do the writing for me.
I think that's a wonderful approach. Now, sometimes I think it also helps to have kind of a
circuitous.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's a lot of word for me early on a Saturday morning. Uh-huh. So, but to make your point in kind of a roundabout way. So, in fact, sometimes people don't see your point coming.
Well, that's good. I understand that. There's a little bit of fun in surprise. That's what you're talking about now, and that's nice. And so when I talk about directness, you can be direct indirectly. That's okay.
Okay, good. You know, I like that. I like that philosophy. So be direct in an indirect way. That's very good. You know, one of the things that I find extremely striking about you when I read your work is how broad of a range of subject matter you've been able to explore over time.
It helps to be 92, you know. If you begin writing, let's say, when you're 8, and you have, therefore, 84, 85 years of life left, you're gonna have to spread your wings. You can't just crawl along in one narrow rut. And so people think of me as a sports writer. Well, I've written some books on sports. I'm a Western novelist also. I wrote 5 Western novels, including the first Western novel with a black protagonist. Which upset the publisher so much. He said, no, we love this novel of yours, and we're going to publish it, but you have to change the race of your protagonist, because there were no such things as black cowboys. I said, well, then beginning with my novel, there will be one, because I'm not going to change that, and they acceded. A month or so before that novel came out, another book came out called The Black Cowboy. It turned out after the Civil War, when blacks went north into the industrial parts of the country, they also went west because they were agricultural, and that's where the ranch lands were. And 70% of all the ranches had, 70% were hired people who were black. And so my first black was not the first black at all. Anyway, I've written education, I've written environmental, I've written short stories. I even wrote the libretto notes for 2 seasons of opera that were apparently so good that somebody plagiarized them. And when they wrote libretto notes for a Verdi opera, they just used mine. And I found that very, very flattering.
Okay. My initial response was somewhat disturbing, but I guess, you know, flattering is one way to spin it. So.
Well, I looked up the person who did it, and I said, those libretto notes you used, they were mine. He said, you bet they were. I said, why did you do it? He said, you're a better writer than I am. So there.
Well, you know, you really can't argue with that.
I could
though.
Not. I went away feeling very flattered by the whole experience of being stolen.
Well, you know, that's probably one of the keys to your aging well is a very healthy attitude. So, because I'm not sure that my head wouldn't have been spinning had I seen that. So, I'm not sure what it says about me, but we'll gloss right over that one. Well, but one of the things that I've really enjoyed that you've written is called "A Day in the Bleachers." It's your account of the first day. First game of the 1954 World Series. I wanted to find out what it was like actually writing that because, I grew up a very avid sports fan. My love of baseball has somewhat diminished over time, but I love reading about the history. So what was it like preparing something like that?
Well, I didn't go to the game prepared to write about it. I went to the game prepared to see a game. It was a World Series game. It was in New York City. I could take the subway there and spend $2.20 and buy a ticket and sit in the bleachers. Sitting in the bleachers that day was a virtue because in that game, Willie Mays made his great catch of a ball hit by Vic Wertz in the eighth inning of a 2-2 ball game and saved the game for the Giants, which was my team. And I was 50 feet away from it, whereas all the writers in the press box were 500 feet away from it when it happened. So when I got home, I took my notes. I had made notes on programs. I had made notes in the gutters of the columns of the New York Times that I carried with me that day. And I thought, gee, maybe this is something more than just a story about one ball game. Maybe it's something else. I'll try a magazine piece out of it. The New Yorker's running pieces like that. So I wrote a 10,000-word story of that day, brought it to the New Yorker, and the young guy came out and said, what did you want? I said, I want somebody to read this in a hurry because if you want to run it, you got to run it right away. And he was very polite and he took it upstairs and he came down an hour later and said, they liked it, but they said it was not for them. And so I thanked them and I went home. I thought that was very nice, by the way, of the way they treated me. I took it home and I looked at it and I said, he's right. That they're right. It's not a magazine piece. It's a book. And so I decided to turn this day into a book of my life that day. It's a book about fandom. It's a book about fanhood. It's not a book about a baseball game so much as it is about bantering with the fans next to me, watching the couple who were playing Casino, and he didn't. The one of them didn't know that he should have taken the 2, the 3, and the ace with his 6 that he had, and things like that. And I had 2 cigars and 3 beers, and I had a wonderful day arguing with a woman in a red beret who was a Dodger fan, and I'm a Giant fan, and she was, maybe 15 feet away from me, and we snarled at each other all through the game. It grew, and it's not a big book. It's a 155-page book, so it's a small book.
I don't know, but it sounds like it was a great experience. I remember actually the very first game I attended as a child was also at, mine was at Yankee Stadium. Yours was at the Polo Grounds.
That's right.
And I just remember walking into that stadium and just feeling that I was in a place of history, at least great sports history, so many different events from boxing to football to, you know, amazing baseball games and some of history's great names in baseball having played on that field and just seeing the pristine grass and the architecture. It was just a phenomenal experience for a kid.
George Vesey, who writes sports for the New York Times, said that baseball is the only sport that's played in the park. The greenery of the game, it is a beautiful place. A baseball field is a beautiful place to be. And so I appreciate how you felt about Yankee Stadium. I felt the same way. I saw Babe Ruth play ball games in Yankee Stadium. One of the most interesting moments of my Babe Ruth stories is that my father came into the kitchen one night after we had supper. My brother and I were doing the dishes. and he said, boys, let's go to the stadium tomorrow. The Babe is going to pitch. Babe Ruth was going to pitch in 1933 a ball game for the Yankees. People think of him only coming from the Red Sox, where he was the pitcher, to the to play right field for the Yankees. But he also appeared in four games as a pitcher with the Yankees. He won all four games. He pitched that game, and he went the whole way. He won the ball game. The Yankees won 6-4, 7-4, something like that. And I saw Babe Ruth a week or two later coming across the street in Broadway, on Broadway, crossing 81st Street with his wife and his daughter. So I ran up to him, and I said, hi, Babe. He said, hi, kid. I said, I saw that game you pitched a few weeks ago. And, oh, yeah, he beamed. He was wearing a great polo coat and a cap. And I said, how come you didn't strike out anybody? And he said, he laughed. He said, I wanted those 8 palookas behind me to earn their keep. And so that's my Babe Ruth story. I mean, I saw him face to face.
You know what? If there were one person in the history of baseball who I would like to sit down and have a cup of coffee with or have a nice breakfast with, it would probably be Babe Ruth. I just the stories and just the personality would just be phenomenal.
He would snort at you, sneered at you if it was coffee, and he would said, "You mean a beer, don't you, fella? Yeah, come on, kid. Now you mean a beer? You mean a bourbon? You don't mean coffee, anyway."
Well, you know, I several years ago, I did a project with Randy Johnson. Some people may remember him as a great pitcher for Seattle, Arizona, and briefly for the New York Yankees at the end of his career. I think somewhere in there he had a couple of months with Houston. But what was really interesting was, you know, at the time he was considered to be the most feared pitcher in all of baseball.
Well, he was 6'10", among other things.
Exactly, and with great arm length. And so by the time he actually released the ball, you know, he was, okay, so let's figure.
He's 52, 53 feet away from the plate.
Yeah, he's 52 feet away, and he's throwing the ball, you know, aggressively towards you, let's just say, you know, 100-plus miles an hour. Uh-huh. But the funniest part of it was that he was quiet during all of our meetings. He was almost dead silent. And his wife, Lisa, also very, very lovely to work with, his Lisa kind of ran things. Uh-huh. Only when it was something that was particularly important to him would he chime in. And all I could think of was, boy, if the batters who he faces on a regular basis could see him politely deferring the way he did to his wife, then, you know, they would understand how little hope there is for so many other married men out there. But it was wonderful, you know, really, as I say, really lovely couple. And it's funny how, you know, how much they could influence us and just how we perceive individuals. So it was a lot of fun. You know, you grew up watching the New York Yankees, and then I understand you became a Giants fan.
Well, I was born in 1922, and for the first 4 years of my life, we lived in Washington Heights and Edgecombe Avenue, one block away from the Polo Grounds. Now, the Polo Grounds was not just home to the Giants. It was home to the Giants and the Yankees until 1923, when the Yankee Stadium was built and they moved across the river, the Yankees did. But and because of my craze for Babe Ruth, I love Babe Ruth. I was to that degree a Yankee fan until 1926, when the Cardinals beat them, and my brother, who was a Giant fan, said, "See, I told you they were lousy." And so I shifted over to become a Giant fan, beginning 1927, when the dynasty of the Yankees really began. So there I was, suddenly no longer a Yankee fan, watching them just rule baseball.
Did you ever give your brother a hard time for shifting your allegiances? Because it sounds like something you needed to poke him on.
My brother was the best big brother any human being ever had. So if he felt this way, that was okay with me.
Okay, good. Well, that's a very strong allegiance after taking you away from one of the great dynasties in all of sports.
Well, that's true. But when I say he was a great brother, he was a great brother. And when he was killed in World War II at age 25, I lost my big brother. And I think today of him, especially this last few days when we have D-Day and things like that, just past Memorial Day. I think of him every so often. He remains my big brother, though he's been dead since he was 25 in 1944.
No, you know what? I understand that. And so many people such as yourself, in fact, in my closing today, I'd like to talk about, briefly about D-Day. But so many people like your brother gave everything to protect this country. And, you know, our hearts go out to you and everyone else. Going back to what you were saying about him still being your big brother, I never met any of my grandparents except for one, but I did know my grandmother, her baby brother, who actually lived out here in Malibu. Really a fascinating man. He lived well into his 90s and taught humor at Pepperdine and at UCLA.
Pepperdine can use humor.
Yeah, and he was great. He had a great library collection, and he had a great sense of humor. But even at his age, he was still his sister's baby brother, and he was always the baby. Even his his nephews and his children still thought of him as being the baby in the family. So that's something that is near and dear to us, regardless of where we are in our lives. So it's good to hear that's still with you, for your brother. I wanted to find out, though, you know, are you still the kind of an avid baseball fan that you were growing up? Does it still tug at your heartstrings in the same way as it did when you were a kid?
Differently. It doesn't tug at my heartstrings probably at all. I'm interested. I remain, instead of a New York Giant baseball fan, I'm a San Francisco Giant baseball fan. And surprisingly, they are the best team in baseball. This surprises me. It astounds me. I don't believe it. But if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. It will not kill me. Bart Giamatti, when he was the commissioner of baseball, he said, baseball will break your heart. It is intended to break your heart. Well, it broke my heart many, many, many times when I was young and growing up. It doesn't do that anymore.
Well, we've seen baseball has changed so much over the last generation.
Yes.
And I apologize for our listeners. You're listening to KX at One Laguna. The show is Perspectives with Dr. Ari Grayson. And I have with me as my guest today in the studio a true treasure here in Laguna Beach, Mr. Arnold Hano. Mr. Arnold Hano.
My son says it's Hano as in Drano. Maybe that will help you.
Hopefully it will. So my apologies.
That's okay.
If we've only got an hour today on the show, are you okay? Do you want to keep going?
I can keep going. I can do an hour or more.
Great, because we were going to take a break, but I'd rather not deprive my listeners of the opportunity to hear more of what you have to offer us. So thank you for that.
Poor souls they are.
Well, you know, it's Saturday. There's nothing much to do in Laguna, so...
Yeah.
No, and please don't tune off your radio and go find out if that's true. So, or your computer in this case. But we have seen the game changed over the years.
Yes.
And I was wondering, you know, you had mentioned that you truly loved watching Babe Ruth hit a home run, that it was such a treat to see him, walk up to the plate, and just the kind of power and grace that the man had. Both as an athlete and as a person. Did you have the same kind of enthusiasm in the late 80s and the 90s when we had players such as Barry Bonds and Mark McGwire who were hitting home runs at such an incredible pace, but their totals were padded by alleged steroid use?
You've more or less answered the question with what you just said. I was still a Giant fan, and I admired that Barry Bonds was hitting the ball 5 miles. And when Mark McGwire was up, you knew he was going to hit the ball into the upper deck, if not more than that. But when it came out that this was based as much on their skill as it was on their shot in the arm, or however they took the stuff, then it lost a good piece of its thrill. I appreciate athletes, and I appreciate what they've done. I like it to be clean, if possible. I I'm with Giamatti when he refused to allow Pete Rose into the Hall of Fame because of his gambling, betting on games that were in place, games that he played in. I don't like that. I remember when my father told me about Hal Chase, the first baseman, way back when. He said he was a wonderful first baseman. He was a terrible human being. Well, sometimes you have to weigh those two things and decide which one is more important in your own estimation.
Well, and sometimes having villains and protagonists in our lives are actually a good thing because it gives us somebody to kind of to root against.
It helps me in my writing, by the way. I don't like pure heroes. I put a touch of villainy into my heroes. And I don't like pure villains. I put a touch of heroism in my villains. And I like doing that. And I am surprised when other writers don't do that. I don't like that all-out 100% something or other. It's ridiculous. It's not true. It doesn't exist.
Well, you know, and I think that's an important thing to keep in mind always is that no matter how much we idolize a person or how much we idealize them, they have flaws. They are imperfect. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we sometimes like to attribute bad motives to people and we think of them as pure evil. And that's very, very rarely the case. You know?
Well, it's a word I never use, evil. It's a religious word, and I tend not to be very religious.
And even in that, you know, as you were saying, even the darkest of villains have something redeeming about them. Well, hopefully, have something redeeming about them. So we need to look at that.
I was an editor at Lion Books. I was the editor in chief at Lion Books when I was introduced to Jim Thompson, who had written three hardcover books that went nowhere, and he wanted to start to do something that might be better. And he did a novel for us called The Killer Inside Me. And when I read it the first night that I had it home, it blew the top of my head off. Here he had a villain, a terrible, horrible human being, and you saw him from inches away, and yet there was part of you that rooted for him. And it speaks to what you just said. And Thompson became a great suspense novelist and maybe the best of all the noir novelists. If I mentioned what I just said now, if I were in Paris when I was saying it, they would build a statue to me because they thought Thompson was like Molière or Dumas or anybody of worth in literature. Anyway,
You know, despite your love of sports, which is plainly clear, yeah. You also appear to enjoy writing about a broad range of other topical subjects, especially your beloved community here of Laguna Beach. So I wanted to find out what about your community you find most enjoyable.
That's hard. I suppose it's the fact that if I got up at 4 in the morning and stood on the street corner of Forest Avenue and Coast Highway and said, blue is blue, six people would be outside in a minute saying, no, blue is green, blue is yellow, blue is red, blue is... there's something about the people in Laguna who either love a good fight or insist that it's not really a fight, it's the way things are. And it's a very active... You know, for a sleepy little town, here it is on the Pacific. It should be bathed only in sunshine and bliss and wonderment. It's always fussing. When I titled this book, "It Takes a Villager," in a way, it was a sidewise swipe at Hillary Clinton, who wrote a book called "It Takes a Village to Raise a Child." I said out loud to somebody, "It takes a village to raise the roof." It takes a villager to raise the roof. And Bonnie said, no, she said, it's my Bonnie. She said, it takes a villager to raise a ruckus. And she was right, as she's always right. And so there's something about Laguna, it doesn't let people, it looks out for the other side every so often. I myself have found that I'm on the side of the other. When I came to Laguna in 1955, I discovered very soon thereafter that black males in Laguna could not get their hair cut in white barbershops in Laguna Beach, barbershops, the six barbershops. They would not have a black man come into their barbershop. Can't cut that hair, can't cut that kind of hair. And I looked up the law, and I found there was an accommodation law written in 1905 that said you had to cut that law, barbershops, etc. If you open to the public, you open to the public. You don't open to pieces of the public. And so I pursued that with these barbershops. No, no, I can't do that. I can't cut that hair. And finally, one of them said, look, if I cut one black man's hair, I'll lose all my white customers. I said, not if everybody has to do it. I said, where are they going to go for their haircut? They're going to go to Santa Ana, to Long Beach, the way these blacks have to do that? Well, they still couldn't do it, so we went to the cops, we went to the press, and on a certain Saturday, we marched a black man and a white man into six barbershops at the same time with a cop in that barbershop, and they had to cut the hair of that black guy, because if they said, no, we can't cut your hair, and then immediately cut the white guy's hair, they were breaking the law. And so we won that fight. We won the fight 5/6 of the way. One of those barbers closed his shop and left town. He just couldn't handle it. Anyway,
that sounds like a Lester Maddox approach. Lester Maddox being the segregationist former governor of Georgia, who said he'd shut the door of his restaurant before he would serve any person of color.
Uh-huh. Can I tell you a baseball color story also?
Absolutely.
When the Giants played a game in Pittsburgh in 1962, 1963, the game was over, and they had heard about this restaurant and that was very, very good in the neighborhood, and Orlando Cepeda and Felipe Alou, dressed to the nines, one 6'2", the other 6'3", straight as rods, probably the two handsomest men in Pittsburgh on that evening, walked into this restaurant. And the maitre d' saw them and came running out and said, we don't serve Negroes. And Cepeda laughed and said, that's okay, we don't eat them.
Okay, good.
But they could not be seated in that restaurant.
Okay, so nice to know that it wasn't just a Southern problem. If you read John Lewis's book, Walking Against the Wind, you'll see some interesting stories in that. John Lewis is the current sitting congressman from one of Atlanta's congressional districts. He grew up in a small town, Troy, Alabama, uh-huh. And he would describe how the family, when driving to visit relatives in northern states or in Chicago, had to make sure that they had all the food and everything they needed for their journey, because there was no guarantee that driving up through Tennessee and Kentucky and into southern Illinois, that they would ever have a place where they could eat. So, you know, it's interesting to see how far we've actually come, but in some ways we kind of wonder how far we still have to go.
You're right.
But you've made that segue for me, because you're not only just a political writer, as if that weren't enough in and of itself, but you're also somewhat of an activist, and it's something that you definitely seem to revel in.
Well, I like to stick up for the little guy. I remember a meeting in City Hall where Mayor Richard Goldberg, who was also the president of the Chamber of Commerce, announced the appointment of three men to some committee or other. And I was in the audience, and this was better back then than it is today. You could get up at any time, walk to the lectern during a discussion, and you would be recognized, and you could speak. So I walked to the lectern. Goldberg nodded to me. I said, Dick, you've made 16 appointments in the last few months. Every single one of them is a male. I said, wasn't there a single woman, or a married woman, wasn't there a woman that could have done one of those jobs? He and the other members of the council, all men, looked stunned. It just had not occurred to them that they could have hired or looked into a woman. Ed Law, who was the worst of them all on that council, said, as a matter of fact, Arnold, he said, I did think of one woman, but she had just moved to Arizona. So I said, so the only woman worth doing anything didn't even live in the state anymore. And he had to just kind of sit there quietly. Well, the next day, there was somebody from the Fair Employment or the Fair Something or Other Practices Committee in City Hall asking whether this was all true. I had not called anybody. Somebody had called, and women started to get appointed. Now that was worthwhile. That's being an activist and calling your punches. That's one of my favorite moments in Laguna.
And the whole thing would have been so unnecessary had we had Mitt Romney's binder full of women.
Yes, that was incredible.
Problem solved.
Yeah, you're right.
Any case, all right, to our listeners out there, you're listening to KX at One Laguna. The show is Perspectives with Dr. Ari Grayson. I'm Ari, and my guest today is Arnold Haino. Thank you for joining me. Mr. Haino is a local treasure of sorts. He's a wonderful writer and just an absolute joy to have on the show. Why do you think, though, sometimes, and you had mentioned this in some of your writing, that sometimes activist is considered to be a pejorative term?
Well, yeah, I guess so. People would like to think of Laguna as this sun-drenched little community where everybody loves everybody, but in fact, it's not true. And so it needs some activism. I came from New York City. You know, that's a sharp elbowed town. You don't get along in New York City unless you can give as well as you take. There's a little bit of fuss in me, a little bit of I don't take crap from nobody kind of in me. And so I don't care whether activism is a dirty word or not. Here I am, all 5 feet, 7 inches of me, 140 pounds of me, take me on.
Well, you know, and the reality is that being an activist means, in my mind, you know, just stirring the conversation, providing different points of view rather than thinking we have an answer. One of the first gentlemen that I worked for in a professional capacity always taught me, don't fall in love with your first idea. Uh-huh. And I think we have a tendency to do that. And it doesn't matter whether you're conservative or you're progressive. Everybody has the same kinds of tendencies. And that is, you know, we have an idea, we may think it's wonderful. And if it weren't for the activists among us challenging our cognitive beliefs, our cognitive structures, you know, things wouldn't get better.
You see what you're saying? Murder your little darlings.
Yes, murder those darling ideas that you hold so dear, uh-huh. and seek new ones. Uh-huh. And if those ideas are actually good and solid, they'll come back around.
Right.
You know, they'll still be there. One of the things that you have been very active with over the years is you were actually the founding chair of Village Laguna. Uh-huh. And you did that. You founded it well over 40 years ago. Village Laguna is still very active today. So I was wondering if you wouldn't mind perhaps telling our listeners why Village Laguna was founded and perhaps shed a little bit of light onto what the organization, what the group is doing today.
The group is doing its best today to keep Laguna, to preserve what is best and about the old part of Laguna, and to be chary about progress, because progress sometimes means more big buildings, more commercial crap, and more traffic as a result. Village Laguna came about because that same council that couldn't find a woman to fill any of those jobs also decided that one way to make money in Laguna was to have a row of high-rise hotels on our beach, beginning at Broadway and working its way south to Bluebird Canyon, maybe a mile and an eighth of hotels, maybe six or eight hotels, of 10 stories, 100 feet high. And with our very lax variance laws, it could have been 200 feet high, 300 feet high. So we formed an organization to fight that new zone that was being proposed. Roger McElhane, who is today on the design review board, built a model of what the city would look like from Broadway down to Bluebird Canyon, and we took it to the Planning Commission, which was going to hear the arguments on this zone, and we had it covered in a white sheet, and we pulled off the white sheet, and they could see these big things, and then the little buildings looking like thumbnails compared to full hands on this model. And a commissioner said to me after that, "When you guys pulled the sheet off that thing, that zone was dead." And that was some of the things that Village Laguna did back then. That once the council wanted to see how big Village Laguna could become population-wise, we were, I think, around 14,000 in 1970 or something like that. And they wanted to know what's the growth potential, meaning really how big can we get to make this town? And they hired an outside urban planner or whatever, a company that does things like that. And they came back after studying it all with 35,000. We could be a town of 35,000 in a few years. And we didn't like that. Village Laguna did not like that. And I spoke up and I said, I think we can do better than that. They said, show us. So we did. We went to work and we planned and we showed how to use zoning and we came up with 18,500 as a good lid on this town of 14,000. We can go that high, and it was presented to the Planning Commission, and they ended up settling for 20,000 instead of 35,000. So those are the things that Village Laguna did and keeps doing. We'll fight to save an old tree. We'll fight to save an old building. We care about these things.
Well, it's amazing to have people such as yourself who are so engaged. I know now there's talk about a view protection law, and that would require cutting down trees or limiting tree height and so forth. I have very mixed emotions. I haven't heard all of the arguments on both sides yet, but trees are what give character and warmth to a community, and I understand the need to see and the motivation to want to see the water and the open spaces. But by the same token, what would the town look like if we didn't have so many of these wonderful and precious trees all around us? And what unintended consequences might that have? But speaking of building in a way that may not have positive effects on the village character that we have here in Laguna, you wrote a column that is actually my favorite. It was called Laguna Marina Fui. I'll let you explain it, but Laguna is now a marine life protected area. That would not have been possible had a marina been built. But can you tell me what that argument was and what was hoped to happen by some?
I was writing a column for the Laguna Beach Post, which was owned by a couple of guys, Bud Desenberg and John Weld. Bud Desenberg was there every day. John Weld wrote a column, and he also had the Ford dealership in town. But Bud was a hands-on editor, publisher, but he lived in Corona del Mar, and he loved Newport Beach, and he wanted Laguna Beach to be Newport Beach. And so he thought the best thing to do is to turn all that wonderful beachfront and all that water into a marina with yachts and dinghies and sailboats all nestled closely together, and that taking over of what was a swimming surfing beach and turning town a swimming and surfing town and turning it into Newport Beach, and so even though he was my boss, I engaged that argument and argued that this is not what Laguna is nor what Laguna should be. And so far, there's no marina. And so I guess I consider that one of my long-term victories. Usually when I win some of these things, 4 or 5 years later, I lose them on a second round. But this time, the rounds have come and gone. Bud died a few years ago. He was about my age, and he still lived in Corona del Mar.
Well, and I think that speaks directly to the kind of vigilance that people in the community need to maintain, because on so many of these issues, we only need to lose the battle once, and the character of the town is changed forever.
Yeah, that is true. It it's not quite as true as I used to think it was. Because sometimes we lose and we come back and we redo it another way and we slow them down. We may not stop them. They're going to be the let's make Laguna bigger, better, richer. Is going to go on. It's going to continue. And to a degree, I suppose they're winning that battle. But Laguna's still Laguna. People say to me, "Gee, hasn't it changed a lot in those 58 years that you've lived here?" Well, more, you know what's changed? The things around us have changed. There was no such thing as the Saddleback Valley having had towns in them. Now when you go up there, look down, you don't see horses and Black Angus. You see houses and businesses. And so to a degree, what it is that we are such a gem, everybody comes here. So we have traffic and congestion that fills us all the time. It isn't just now August that it happens. It used to be just August that we would suffer. Now it's every weekend. When the pageant opens on July 5th, it'll just be awful, except it's not, because we will retain our own identity somehow or other. Even the bad guys who think of progress in those terms that I've described as a pejorative, they also they say, and I believe them, that they love Laguna. And to love Laguna means you've got to have some of these virtues, some of these characteristics that I've been describing. And so even as we lose and the leadership is awful, that's not as bad as it could be.
Well, and we do see activist groups today that help to maintain the kind of character that we have in our town. I don't think they're to stop progress, but just to be careful and respectful of what we have and to appreciate the fact that we have something unique, that we have something very special here in Laguna Beach, that we need to be very careful about how we develop, because as you well know, the law of unintended consequences will always rear its ugly head, and you wind up sometimes creating more problems than you actually resolve. You know, we've had other groups that have developed over recent years, for example, Let Laguna Vote, which was instrumental as an organization in organizing the community and defeating the Village Entrance Project, which was really just a glorified parking structure at the festivals and would have really been an eyesore for our community. But that kind of activism, it's so important, and it's great to see that that's still going on today. I can't actually even get my head around this, but we're just about out of time.
We are.
We are. You know what? We've just got a couple of minutes. Those of you who are listening, you are at KX at One Laguna. The show is Perspectives with Ari Grayson. My guest today has been Arnold Haino, a Laguna treasure and writer and activist here in the community. So I want to thank Arnold for joining me here today. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It was not as scary as I expected it would be.
I didn't imagine that it would be. You know, these things often appear worse coming at you than they do in the rearview mirror. But one of the things that I'd like to do in closing is I'd like to salute and honor the American veterans all around us and those who have given our lives. I want to give special thanks to those who have fought and literally saved the world during the D-Day invasion, which was honored yesterday for its 70th anniversary. So many of our friends, family members, our neighbors have lost loved ones or lost loved ones in that great battle and throughout the course of World War II. I came to learn today that Mr. Haino's older brother was one of those American veterans who lost his life at the young age of 25. But those veterans helped the world survive one of its darkest periods in its history. The ranks of those surviving veterans are thinning.
You know how thinning they are?
There's only a couple of hundred, I believe.
No, we were 16 million in the armed services in World War II, and we're down to under 3 million now. And we lose about 1,000 a day.
And I'm sorry, what? How many survivors are there currently?
Of World War II?
Yes.
A little bit under 3 million. We're still here.
Okay. That sounds like a pretty good number at this point. But
well, out of 16 million, it's a fifth and less than that, yes.
It's not, but the war ended, what, let's see, 45. Almost 70 years ago. That would be the D-Day invasion was the beginning of the end.
Yes.
But I did want to make sure that we thank all of our veterans, whether it was from World War II or the people who are serving in our military today. Thank you all. You know what? Even to say thank you just feels like a feeble expression because I don't think it can completely convey the debt of gratitude that we owe our armed forces. So I want to wish all of our listeners a good week. I hope you'll tune in next week and be back to listen to us again in the future. But thank you so much for joining me here today. I'm going to leave you with a little bit of music. Hopefully you will get out and have a wonderful day here. It's beautiful in Laguna Beach. So once again, have a great week, and we hope to hear you again soon or be with you soon. Take care.